It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. You know, before fake news, before alternative facts, there was The Daily Show's resident expert, John Hodgman. He's the guy who would make stuff up about, say, an American president and say it with a straight face.
Take Abraham Lincoln. Before every major Civil War battle, Lincoln consulted a personal religious advisor whose name was Phineas Gurley.
Now, all right, that name sounds made up.
No, that's a real person, but he got that a lot. Jefferson Davis, the Confederate president, also had a spiritual advisor, name of Greasy Face Q McFancy Dancer.
John Hodgman, still funny, but he's not an expert anymore. His new book, Vacation Land, is a collection of personal stories about living in Maine and getting older and feeling irrelevant. He told KUOW's Jeannie Yandel why he wanted to move on from fake facts.
Part of my retreat from fake facts is that even when I was doing them, it was never enough to simply say something absurd to get a laugh. There had to be in the fake fact a kernel, some kernel of truth, or of honesty, or a reflection of truth. When I wrote my list of the nine U.S. presidents who had secretly had hooks for hands as a joke, and I wrote about how Franklin Roosevelt had a hook for a hand, but no one knew about it because he was always photographed from the wrist up. That was a reflection of the fact that there was this mutual understanding among the press that no one would ever talk about the fact that Franklin Roosevelt was disabled. He had polio and he needed a wheelchair and there was an illusion based around him. Mm. And I never wanted to do stuff that was just absurd. And now when we're in a place where facts are disputed left and right, it didn't feel like a mission. Again, I just did what I had to do, but it felt like the most honest thing I could do was just be honest and hope that resonated.
There is a lot there that sounds like you wrote it from Seattle. You talk about trying to prove your relevance by what music you like and running into your 90s music hero in town and keeping yourself from gushing over how much his music meant to you. I mean, you even talk about marijuana edibles. Are you planning to move here?
Well, I don't want to have to ruin your delusion, but not everything is about Seattle.
What?
I know that Seattle feels very strongly that it is. Seattle is very much like me in that regard. I grew up as an only child, thinking the entire universe was organized around what I thought was interesting and cool. But in fact, I had to learn, as the book is largely about, that the universe is not organized around me, and that I am just one atom in a million spilling through existence. That is what Seattle is too.
The book is basically about you coming to terms with the fact that you're not the center of the universe. So are you comfortable with that understanding now, or are you still struggling with it?
I don't think it would be fair to say that I've ever been comfortable at all from childhood into what is now my middle adulthood. But I have come to accept a few difficult truths, one of which is that I am no longer young, but in fact am middle-aged. That I have a beard that looks terrible and it will never look better. Now that I've grown it and see what it looks like, I realize that I look like either the IT guy for the Church of Satan or the part-time bookkeeper for the Duck Dynasty. But in life, we grow the beards we can, metaphorically speaking, of course, and you have to come to some acceptance of where you are in life and who you are in life if you're going to be anything that resembles comfortable and happy. Sometimes you just have to accept you're not comfortable, and I never, ever am.
The notion of being uncomfortable in your own skin comes up a lot in the book, and that sort of almost sneakily moves into this discussion of you calling out your own privilege. I was surprised to see that come up so much, particularly in the second half of the book. Why was that important to you to do? Why did you want to do that?
Well, it was John Roderick, the great citizen of Seattle, my dear friend, lead singer of the Long Winters.
City council candidate, yes.
Former city council candidate, and I still believe future mayor of Seattle, who back announced me when we were both performing in Santa Fe a couple of years ago, and I started telling some of these stories, these new, straightforward, personal stories on stage that I was telling, and I just thought I was telling the story of my life, not thinking very much more about it than that. And John got up and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the white privilege comedy of John Hodgman." And I was, It was like I jumped into cold water. I'm like, oh, of course that's what's going on here. I mean, the definition of privilege is in some way you don't realize you have it. And when it's revealed to you, it's embarrassing. And I realized, oh yeah, this is in some level a comedy show at that time and now a book. The central dilemma of which is, I now own two summer homes. Mm-hmm. Are you enjoying my relatable comedy? But then I realized, you know, you only grow the beard you can grow in life. And my weird fates and fortunes have led me to where I am. And I don't feel I want to apologize for who I am in life. But it's important to be aware of the privilege you have and to not ignore it. And that there is a moment in the book that reflects a very real and sobering moment from a couple of summers ago when I was in Maine and, you know, it was midsummer and I was enjoying myself and relaxing in the painful state that also happens to be one of the most Caucasian states in the nation. And the news about the police shootings of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling came in quick succession, and the Black Lives Matter protests that emerged from that and the rather unseemly and dumb counter protests online suggesting that that you can't say that Black Lives Matter because it somehow diminishes the power and privilege of white people. I mean, I couldn't figure out what they were trying to say, but it was weird. And there I was, processing all of this pain and anger and frustration, and realizing very distinctly that I could just close my computer and walk away and walk away and not have to, and turn off the whole concept of race, because where we were in coastal Maine is so profoundly Caucasian that I wouldn't have to think about race at all. And that is an incredible privilege. I don't want to say that there are no people of color in our town. There are, but statistically speaking, I was capable of experiencing a kind of blind, dumb delusion that I was default humanity that is rapidly and rightly disappearing in an increasingly multicultural world. And it was time to stop thinking of myself as normal, a normal person for whom race is a conversation you have every now and then at an enlightened dinner party, but appreciate that race and privilege, point of view, oppression, and all of those issues that people who don't look like me live with in their skin every day, I have to live with it in my skin too and be open to the criticism that people might throw at me without throwing up big defenses saying, well, all lives matter, don't they? Like that kind of sophomoric bull feces has to end.
So what does that look like for you, that awareness, especially given the fact that, as you said, you don't really have to think about it if you don't want
to? Right. But I mean, I do have to think about it and I do have to make efforts to educate myself. But I think mostly my job is to get out of the way of other voices, which is a weird thing to say when you're being interviewed on a radio to,
yes,
to promote a book that you wrote. One of my heroes is the writer E.B. White, whom I knew of obviously from Charlotte's Web, but only more recently in my life began to appreciate his work as an essayist, writing about his normal life in Maine. And he was writing about a very white world. It's right there in his name. But it was his life. Every life is worth writing about. But E.B. White was special because for all the white dudes that I've ever read, E.B. White was perhaps the least braggy. He was a guy who, when people would come to see him after he was already sort of famous at the New Yorker, he didn't want fame or even appreciation for what he did. He needed to write what he had to write. He offered it humbly, and then he wanted to disappear. And when people came to visit him, he literally got out on the fire escape and ran away.
Wow.
That, I think, is the model that if you're a creative person who looks like me and a straight white man of some affluence now thanks to television, you know, I have to offer what I have to offer. That's all I got. I can only grow the beard that I can grow. All I can do is offer it humbly, and when it's some time for someone else to talk, get out of the way. I guess you enjoyed hearing a white man explain all of that to you. You're welcome. There's no mansplaining like white mansplaining, because white mansplaining don't stop.
Thank you very much for explaining all of that to me. Fine. But
oh, you're welcome.
But you're also...
Someday maybe you'll have something to say, too. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. Yeah. But it's a delicate balance, because, you know, there's part of me that literally would like to just disappear into the woods. You know, white culture has imagined of itself default humanity, against which every other culture, race, religion, creed, whatever, personhood is considered exotic or strange or other. That's all changing, right? Whiteness is facing a midlife crisis, because we know, if we don't know, we sense that we're no longer going to be a majority culture in this nation. We're soon going to be a minority among many. And people that are having a hard... It's just like middle-aged dads who want to admit they're still cool. Like, you know, like, there's like, you know, white people who fight against what is inevitable, which is the increasing diversity of this nation. They're as sad as a dad buying a Bentley. It's so sad. When those awful dudes marched in Charlottesville chanting, "Jews will not replace us, you will not replace us," like, I felt a really horrible, dark, middle-aged white guy echo whenever I meet a young comedian, which is, you're not going to replace me. I still got jokes. Mm. Fact is, we'll all be replaced. And there's a value in getting out of the way. And part of me wishes I could just get out of the way and disappear into Maine, into the darkness, and maybe I should. But I still have things I want to say, and I still have bills to pay. So you're going to get some of this anyway.
John Hodgman's new book is called Vacation Land, True Stories from Painful Beaches. He talked with Ginny Yandel, and you can hear more Hodgman. He'll be on stage at Seattle First Baptist Church on Saturday night talking with the Seattle citizen that he mentioned before, John Roderick. We're sharing a link for tickets with you right now on Twitter, @KUOW.